we are not completely reinventing the wheel. We follow the standard underwriting process on credit history. We have different surrogate programs. So either based on the credit history or based on the employment type, if it's a homeowner, then we might not ask for too many documents and give an instant decision, just purely based like within 2-3 minutes. So we have our in-house rule engine, which makes a decision. That would be about like 40% of cases. 60% of cases then goes to a credit manager who do a quick review. But I would say the secret sauce comes from this whole purpose-driven underwriting. So we are better able to understand based on the situation of the customer and based on what they're going for, would that loan make sense at all? If I give you an example in education, a student who is going for a data science course has a very good credit history, but is an art student. They've never really done anything on data or math or coding before. We would be a little skeptical to approve their loan because they might have a high chance of dropping out of the course and then not wanting to repay the loan. Whereas in someone who's coming from a poor background, but he's finished the engineering and then doing a data science course, we know that they have a high chance of getting a good job. So we would be happy to approve. So these are the type of purpose and behavior-driven insights based on which we would be doing underwriting, which other people wouldn't.
Hi, Aditya. It's a pleasure having you in the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Mori. Excited to be here.
This podcast is all about how can we build better fintech such that we can have more impact as such. So we ask ourselves questions like, how can we add more value to customers? Why are we solving the relevant problems? How can we use tech and the fintech ecosystem for good? And questions that basically lead to impact. So to get started, in your opinion, how can we build more purpose-driven fintechs?
We need the right DNA in terms of fin and tech. I think the first wave of fintech was a lot more focused on tech. You had that move fast and break things, like the Facebook quote, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg's quote. And somewhere, I think there was too much of a focus on growth and not enough focus on impact on the end user impact that might be happening, or not enough focus on regulation or compliance. So I think that pendulum needs to come somewhere in the middle and just balance out.
Definitely. So specific to you, so you have this, it's not just a phrase, this ethos that it's like fair finance to everyone. And I love it. What does that mean?
Yes. Fair finance to us means the right amount of credit at the right cost at the right time. If you put in terms of actionable insights and in terms of credit, there's also the right deployment of money as an investor, again, at the right time and for the right risk. So we are doing both sides. Today, when we started, we were only lending from our balance sheet as a registered lender with the RBI. Now we have got one more license where we can facilitate peer-to-peer lending. So initially, we wanted to make sure that we can deliver, every deserving Indian should get access to credit. I think it's still a long way to go. It's such a big market and such a big problem. I don't think we've made enough of a dent. But I'm hoping over the next 5-10 years, we can get to that level where, yeah, we can solve at least some good part of this problem.
Yes. And then just for background, before we deep dive into the problem and such, but just as background for anyone who's listening, Aditya and I met many years ago when we were both working in Tandem Bank. So this is like when Tandem was just getting started, right? So
exactly.
Both of us, yes, were pioneers when it comes to the fintech kind of scene. And then you went and did multiple stuff. And yes, then you became a founder, which is amazing, right? I'm still not a founder. So I admire that in you. So one, as a founder, like having worked in the industry, in fintech startups as such, and with the experience that you have, what was your hypothesis behind starting Creditbury?
Yes. So there was two problems which I faced myself. One is, as a new to credit person in the UK where we met, I saw that actually opening a bank account or something was fine. Getting a credit card also is something I could avail despite being a foreign national in the UK. But in India, actually, it was harder for me to get a credit card. And I realized that despite everything that's happening, like only 4% of Indians have a credit card. So it just made me realize that there's still so much more to be done. Secondly, I worked at this small lender called OCAC after my MBA at London Business School. So there we saw that the Romanian Polish immigrants who are new to credit in the UK were performing a lot better than a lot of the British borrowers actually. So I realized that I should move back to India and become a founder because, you know, the whole financial inclusion new to credit segment is a lot more in India. And I guess actually there's a third aspect, again, maybe from a personal perspective. My family's been in the financial markets for 35 years in the equity markets. And it was very easy for them to invest in equities, very easy to invest in real estate. But when it comes to fixed income or like any alternative to a bank deposit, there weren't many good options. There weren't many trusted options. These are the sort of problems that I faced myself. And then I felt like, why not build something which would work for me and then hopefully work for millions of other Indians.
Definitely. And then especially with India being such a large population and underbanked and unbanked, like both.
Yes.
Which that leads me back to impact. Before we move on fully into you, like when it comes to impact, and we're talking about people living in financial stress, India is a huge part of our population. But if we look at it worldwide, BCG did a report in 2023 where they say that over 3/4 of adults remain either unbanked or underbanked, which is insane, even all the technology that we have today. Right. So this is a very relevant question for us as fintechers to explore, which is, how are you as Creditfair actually having impact on customers' financial lives? How are you actually helping them?
There's multiple aspects. About 25% of our customers never had a credit history. And we saw that after taking a loan from Creditfair, like they built a good score, then they were able to avail more loans or more options after getting into the credit system. But we believe in responsible lending and outcome-driven lending. We don't just wait for someone's credit score to improve. Like, we think that's great and that's a good benefit we can deliver. We look for even more ROI on our business. So we believe in ESG lending, except that our version of ESG is earning, savings and growth. So how do we help an Indian earn more money? We give loans for upskilling courses. So these are young professionals who would not be able to pay for that course upfront. They would need credit. And like I said, they don't have a credit card. They don't have easy access or timely access to credit. Maybe they might have to leave work and spend like a few days at the bank to get a loan, and or we can help them access that course at a click of a button. A lot of our loans are for this someone like who wants to do a data science course, a digital marketing course. And after that, they get a better job. They get a better income at the same job. So that's the type of impact we are already delivering. There are nearly 18,000 students we've helped with the loans that we provided. Similarly, we are having a green impact as well from our work. We are giving loans for rooftop solar, and we've served over 3,000 customers there. So that's leading to over 100,000 pounds of monthly electricity bill savings every month that our customers are getting already. And we're looking to grow this by another 5-10x in the next. These are the different examples of impact that we're doing. And we're very happy with the type of in carbon dioxide savings also that are happening because of the solar rooftop.
That's awesome, because it's very purpose-driven lending as such.
Yeah.
The use cases are very purpose-driven. It's education or on the side as such.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some work we've done on healthcare as well and MSME sector, but that's a smaller part of business.
Okay. You mentioned that you want to grow 5 times to 10 times in the coming years as such. One of my things that keeps me awake at night is we as an industry, as fintechers, we've been around for roughly 10 years, right? Roughly speaking.
Yes.
However, we've had a lot of impact in customer lives. I think we have. However, the problem statement has also grown. The people suffering with financial stress has grown and the cost of living has grown. So I believe if we continue doing what we're doing right now, we will have incremental impact in people's lives. What do we need to be doing today to have 5 times, 10 times impact in 3, 5, 10 years time, rather than just another 10 years of some impact?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in terms of impact, it's did you really change the lifestyle of someone? And yeah, in India, it's did we have a step change on the family is the way we would look at it. So in the case of education, like I mentioned, we've seen many customers who are like farmers or they come from a very small village or city in India. And let's say the father on the household income would be only about 150 to 200 pounds a month. But then because we were able to finance them for a course, then they are able to earn. So the son would be earning basically double, or the child, like the son or daughter would be earning double the income of what the dad would be. And that's just out of court. So then you can see a step change happening, right? In that family, that the household income in a way has tripled from what it was before, and there are two earning members. So now they can actually think about the next, because until then, it's just about survival. Yeah. Actually, fintech cannot really do that much, frankly. Only the government can help that type of customer. But now that the income has grown, so then the questions come, okay, can I take, because my future is bright, I can take a loan to invest in a house. Or I can save so much money and then get a better return and plan for my wedding as a, and not be a burden on my parents, which is a big issue in India. So, yeah, I think that's where it's the biggest problem, at least in the developing world, would be how can we grow incomes faster? And whatever we can do for that, like whether it's helping a small business or helping someone get a job. And then that's what we have to focus.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, because what I find lately, well, in the past few years, is we can start building good money management habits. But right. At the end of the day, the key pain point ends up being, but I need more money. And we're not talking about the, oh, I need more money to go and travel the world. No, this is like at the end of the month. Need more money to pay for their bills. So it's not helping people manage their money and grow their money, but it's going to the root cause, to saying, how can we help them create more money?
Yeah, yeah. I think from a developing world, that is still the problem statement. Of course, for more mature economies, then it's another discipline as well. And the great thing is the technology infrastructure is evolving. Like the Indian government is enabling so much good a data flow based on which we can actually try to help more people. For example, there's something called account aggregator, which is like open banking in the US. So the data can seamlessly flow to us as a financial intermediary. And then we can nudge customers that, hey, why don't you cut spending here? Or why don't you invest more money in something which will give you a better return? The savings rate in India has fallen a bit, but it's still well over 15%. But the problem is that the money is often deployed on very, very risk-averse assets or investments which are maybe missold as well. So I think that is also a problem that definitely needs to be solved.
Definitely. So before we move on into going deeper into your solution as such.
Sure.
Just want to close. Okay, so we have the problem statement. How do we grow? How do we have 5 times or 10 times the impact? Then you gave us potential solutions. So if we were to say, let's stop looking at individuals, fintechs as such, but if we say as a collective, how do we know that we solved financial well-being and financial stress for everyone? What could be the KPIs that you're going to be like, these are the key metrics that we need to measure to ensure that we are tracking impact?
So that's a good question. I think the KPIs should be, you'll have to look at like a control versus like the like a sample which you were able to drive. But it would be that how many people are getting a better return on their savings, right? So if you took the same cohort of customers, you saw that fintech as an industry were able to help so many people, whereas this other control sample just remained the same. To me, that would be really powerful. And similarly, if some people didn't have access to loans from a fintech industry versus some people who did, what happened, right, to their outcomes. And so, yeah, that's the way I would think of it.
I love that last use case that it's, hey, you had access to credit and then you didn't. And then how does it change people's lives?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like a research study piece.
Yeah. So I think that's how I would look at it, because it's very hard to say that, okay, just by making sure someone had a loan, like we achieved something. Until we actually measure that, did that sustainably improve the lives?
Where the keyword is sustainably.
Yes.
And then improve.
Yes, exactly.
So if I think of India as such, India is huge. Right. And you guys have 1.4 billion people.
Yes.
However, access to credit is still a big issue. So out of those 1.4 billion, 1 billion are adults as such. But based on my understanding, chatting with you, we need to corroborate this with Mr. Google.
Sure.
Only out of that 1 billion adults, only 200 million have a credit history.
Yes.
That's bonkers. That is just insane. Can you expand? Like, how did that happen? Why? Tell me more.
And this is after breakneck growth after 5 years. Let's say 5 years ago, it was 100 million people. This is like the trend is positive, but just there's so much ground to cover that it's going to take a while. This has happened because India was a very cash-driven economy. So there was obviously finance, there was informal lending and formal borrowing. And there's a whole cash economy, which was never really recorded, not happening through the banking system. Yeah, because of that, there was very little penetration. But then the last 10, 20 years, there's been a big push towards cashless. The technology has made payments very simple. So then the next step was lending, because without a formal flow of money, lending formally could obviously not happen. And that's what you're seeing now, that you know, that 50 million, 100 million has become 200 to 50 million. And sure, over time, that'll become half a billion Indians who have a credit history.
So we could then extrapolate and say the impact of QR payments in development countries
Yes.
In developing countries, basically moving away from cash, from a cash-based society into a cashless society. Therefore, we have records of people, and those records allow us to offer them other financial services. Therefore, the impact is not just, oh, let's get everyone on QR. The impact of having the data of that QR usage.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a building block. It's laying the foundation of a building, right? So you can only build on top unless if there's a strong foundation. I would not only talk about QR though. The Indian government has done a lot in terms of KYC as well. So the entire Aadhaar stack for KYC is like very easy, very in terms of connections as well. There's direct debit infrastructure is very robust and very accessible. A lot of things have been done across a lot of different parts of the puzzle, and now it's come together.
Stacking up. Definitely.
Exactly. Yes.
So now going deeper into credit fair as such. So we know that the problem statement is huge. And yes, there is 1 billion adults in India. Who do you serve? Because 1 billion is people to say, oh, people in India. So who are your customers? Yeah. What's their segment and their pain points?
Yeah. Yeah, we're not looking to be everything for everybody. Right now, our focus is on a millennial. So someone in the 25 to 35 age group is our prime target, because they would be digitally savvy, and we are trying to do digital onboarding of customers. They would be less averse to debt. That's another reason why the penetration of credit history is also low, because the older generation is actually quite averse to formal debt. So, that's the other aspect. And we go after people from the organized segments. Right now, we're not into the unorganized workforce. So these would be white collar or self-employed people, typically earning $300-$400 per month. And the credit score is actually, interestingly enough, on average, a customer's credit score is 760 or 900, which is pretty prime.
Good.
Yeah. So, our approach is point of sale driven. We have two sets of customers. One is the merchant partner and then the end borrower. So we have to, that's how we identify the point of sale to get our target audience.
So then we've identified your audience. What's your unique value proposition for them? Because they have a good credit score. So I'm assuming they could go to the bank.
Yes. We offer something called no-cost EMI or 0% interest loans, where the merchant partner, so let's say a solar installer, they bear the interest cost, which we deduct upfront, and the customer doesn't pay the interest cost on top of the cost of the product. So because of that, we actually are cheaper than a bank from their perspective, because they don't have to pay anything on the interest. One big USP for us, also about affordability. Many of these customers would not get approved by a bank. Just the fact that we're giving access to credit itself is a value add. And usually it's for when someone is growing their income or saving money. So again, for them, the cost that they are paying to us might be very small compared to the benefit that we get.
Yeah, I totally see that it's okay, the pricing and the accessibility as such. And then you're also focusing on very purpose-specific use cases as such. Yeah, totally makes sense. So you just talked about basically accessibility. And then you say that you could give credit to people that would usually could be rejected in a traditional bank as such. Yeah. How are you assessing creditworthiness? Is it like a traditional way, or what makes you give them credit and not a bank?
So we're not completely reinventing the wheel. We follow the standard underwriting process on credit history. So we have different surrogate programs. So either based on the credit history or based on the employment type, if it's a homeowner, then we might not ask for too many documents and give an instant decision, just purely based, like within 2-3 minutes. So we have our in-house rule engine, which makes a decision. That would be about like 40% of cases. 60% of cases then goes to a credit manager who do a quick review. But I would say the secret sauce comes from this whole purpose-driven underwriting. So we are better able to understand based on the situation of the customer and based on what they're going for, would that loan make sense or not? If I give you an example in education, a student who is going for a data science course has a very good credit history, but is an art student. They've never really done anything on data or math or coding before. We would be a little skeptical to approve their loan because they might have a high chance of dropping out of the course and then not wanting to repay the loan. Whereas in someone who's coming from a poor background, but he's finished the engineering and then doing a data science course, we know that they have a high chance of getting a good job. So we would be happy to approve. So these are the type of purpose and behavior-driven insights based on which we would be doing underwriting, which other people wouldn't.
I have many questions on the back of that. So basically, we're using as an example a student that wants to continue their studies with data science, let's say.
Yeah.
But for student A, the background is a poor background with an engineering degree. And then we, based on that, we assume that they have more likelihood to finish their studies. Therefore, we will lend them. But the other one was a student with, we said, an arts background.
And let's say they did painting, for example.
And then based on that background, we assume that it's likely they will not finish the program.
Yes.
Hence, they will not finish paying.
That's
very interesting. What makes make those assumptions based on my background?
Yeah, based on the experience we've seen on the ground. So the intention to repay is basically what we value as much or if not more than the ability to repay, which is what I was trying to highlight. And those are the two basics of lending. These are the different proxies for intention to repay, which we have a better understanding.
Okay, just to go a bit deeper, for my understanding as well. So we have intention to repay and ability to repay. So ability to repay is basically I have an income minus my expenses and I have my extra money and then I have ability to repay.
That's right.
How do we measure my intention to repay?
Yeah. Yes, there's the credit history. We have a demonstrated track record, of course, which shows your intention to repay. And we assume that should continue. And then these behavioral factors, like I mentioned, like what is your past background while doing this specific purchase? And what will you get out of that purchase? So if that is completely aligned, then your intention to repay will also be much higher.
Interesting. So I think you're already doing this because my assumption is a traditional bank would not assess credit the way that you're doing this.
Yeah, they would. No.
So if we take you as an example, as a pioneer, and then we have a country as large as India, where only 200 million have access to credit.
Yeah.
That is telling me that India as a market is ready for disruption when it comes to the lending market as such. So if we were to build on what you have basically explained to us and we take it at an India level rather than just at a creditor level, how would you go about building alternative credit risk models such that more people have access to lending?
So one is, I just gave you an example of education, but there are hundreds or thousands of other use cases for purchase. So we're doing purchase financing in banking terms, but making a high value product or service accessible with credit is the ultimate goal. So that's where now with rooftop solar, like what unique insights do we have on the rooftop solar market, which helps us underwrite and facilitate credit at the point of sale very quickly compared to a traditional lender. And then there are bunch of other segments which still need to be figured out. And then it's also on the other side. Sorry, just one more point. Let's say the installer of the solar panels, right? They also need credit. They also have other problems which finance needs to solve. So how can we address both sides to really help that industry and help India as a country?
I like that because you're looking at it as an ecosystem. It's not just consumer lending, but you, if there's a purchase, therefore they're going to buy from someone. But then that someone is also a business owner. Right?
Exactly.
So you helping both sides of the...
Yeah.
That is partly what you're doing, right? Because then
so that is exactly what we're doing. I can tell you from the solutions or the approach that I have. Of course, at a very big India level, the government, a lot of the large bodies are doing a lot of work as well to solve this issue. But I can, of course, tell you more about that as well if there is interest. But yeah, I think laying the right infrastructure. So it's you lay the highways, but then you need the cars, you need the cities, you need like the McDonald's along the way to really transform the country. So I think the government has done a good job of laying the highways and the digital public infrastructure. And now like people like us need to take advantage of that and solve a lot of different niche problems along.
So if I were to build on that, we're saying, there's a saying in the industry that it's easy to grow a lending business, e.g. it's easy to acquire customers because we're giving out money. Everyone like money. It's not free, but everybody wants extra money. That's easy to sell. But then the challenge of a lending business is getting that money, getting customers to pay back. So what have you found helped to get that money back? What measures do you have in place?
Yes. One is that whole intent to repay. How can we do that better? So we don't have to focus as much on collections and we can identify the right borrowers before disbursement. So we focus a lot more on that, I would say. But of course, there will be delinquencies, there will be issues. There again, we look at two types of borrowers. One is like where the intention is bad or one where they have a bad financial situation. So if the intention is an issue, like we start taking legal action, we have agencies who would visit the home or we would contact the employers. Those would be the strategies we would employ. And if the financial situation has worsened for the customer, then we would work out some sort of settlement, just collect smaller amounts as what they had to pay every month. And a third way where we have a connection edge is also through the partners from where we're disbursing the loans. If it's an educational institution, they will, many times the customer stops paying, like I said, if they want to drop out of the call. Many of them would be then refunding the fees to us to cover the loan. And in rooftop solar, for example, if the panels are not working properly and the person is, the end customer is not saving enough money on the electricity bills, then that would be covered by the installer as well. Or we can resell the panels to recover some of our loans. So these are the different actions.
Interesting. I'm not an expert in lending, but it's very curious to be like, oh, cool. Yeah, it's all this, like in anything, right? Like you just need to find the problem statement and then go use case by use case and start adding the solutions as such. So as you were talking, what was coming through my mind, and we were talking about collections. Right. Well, of course, AI is here to stay.
Yes.
What's going to be the role of AI in this process in the next 2 to 5 years?
It's hard for me to visualize the future because AI is changing so fast. What I have seen already, though, is that we have AI-driven callers who are like as good or very close to human-like. For example, let's say if you're the borrower, and my AI will call you, you might not realize that it's AI on the other end and it's not a human. It's getting that realistic. The collection efficiency and like the cost of connections can really come down because I don't need to hire like 100 callers to chase like 10,000 borrowers. I might need only 5 or 10. 90% of the borrowers can be handled with my AI machine. So yeah, it's very interesting how the AI caller understand the context and understand your tone of voice, understand the words, and then figure out what to reply to you.
That is cool. That is actually cool.
So that's already happening. So I don't know what's going to happen in 3 to 5 years.
Oh, wow. So if that is already happening, so basically we just need to move our act together. And basically, if we start implementing that as a use case, like you say, it reduces cost of collections. And then the big risk of lending is people not paying back. But then if we can reduce that risk at a low cost as such, then it's a win for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Oh, I love that insight. Thank you.
No worries.
So for us to continue innovating in AI, for us to continue innovating in lending.
Yes.
What are the things that we need to ask ourselves? That's a tough question.
Yeah, from the ground level, I can talk about India. I'm not sure of the rest of the world. I think earlier the regulators were completely hands-off and now they've become very hands-on and they just used to settle a bit in the middle because there's a lot of volatility happening. There's a lot of policies. There's a lot of fear basically of unsecured lending, fear of irresponsible lending, which might be justified in some pockets, but maybe not on average. Yeah, if you need a financial inclusion to be solved, it won't happen from the traditional institutions. We will require new companies, and those new companies will require some support from the government. So I think there is a lot of support, but I'm just worried that the regulators are getting a bit too worried about fintech. So I think that balance is somewhere required. And the others a bit more on the macroeconomics, because interest rates have been rising around the world. The cost of money is really going up everywhere. Inflation is going up a lot. Yeah, the more that can be controlled, the more inflation and interest rates can be more benign, then I think fintech and financial inclusion can be lost.
Cool. So you're giving us many things to think about, basically. I like that. I like this conversation a lot.
Likewise.
So now I want to move away from lending and think more about you as a founder, as an entrepreneur, as such. Okay. So that we get to understand the person behind all these, right?
Yep.
So sure. I want to start with, what is the strategic question in your mind that keeps bugging you all the time?
When am I going to raise the next round from?
Yeah.
No, I think what bugs me, not all the time, but whenever I actually am able to, is that the goal I had set for the company and for myself was helping 1 million Indians improve their finance in 5 odd years. We are 5 years in, but we maybe 7-8% of that. How can in the next 2-3 years I get to that target? That's what keeps coming back to me. How can I maybe step it up a bit more?
That's a good question. That's a really good question, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that keeps coming back to me.
Good. So then maybe this is related to what I was about to ask. That is, being an entrepreneur is a roller coaster.
Yes.
We can be sitting in front of this podcast saying, yeah, we look great, but people don't know what we went through today. You know, and every entrepreneurial journey has its own ups and downs. So how have you managed the resilience and the positivity and like the character building traits in this roller coaster?
So I think you just have so many things. There are so many important things you want to solve. And like, even if you face problems, you just keep focusing on the main issues. What keeps me motivated is the problem statement I mentioned, getting to that impact of 1 million. Now we have a team of about 130 people, actually. So whatever said in that, you're like, you got to take care of the team. And if I'm negative, then that just seeps throughout the organization and that's counterproductive. You got to make sure that even negativity you have, then with your co-founder, you can discuss and resolve as compared. Putting it out there for the entire company. Yeah, I think maybe, I don't know, there are problems, but somehow I guess I feel like we've been lucky that you had a very strong, stable foundation, then we're building on it. Don't get too worried about any problems, because the worst that will happen is that maybe we won't grow as much as we targeted for a few months, but eventually we'll get to the goal. So I think that's what I keep reminding myself.
I like that mindset. Simplified as eventually we will reach our goals.
Yeah,
just keep going. Eventually we will reach our goals.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
And we've seen that actually, that like certain goals we might have taken that we were more conservative or, and that's benefiting us now. As a lot of the other players are not in the best shape, unfortunately. I think, we've seen that over the long term, things really do work in your favor if you just keep working.
Yeah, I was about to ask that follow-up question, that it's, you actually do sound very confident on the statement of, we may not grow that fast, but eventually we will hit our goals. But many, many founders have the challenge of, we don't have the luxury of time, because we don't have that. We don't have the luxury of tons of fundraising. So how do you balance that mindset of, we will get there, with the pressure of, we won't because of fundraising?
Yeah, I think that's where I've been fortunate. Like I was saying, I've been lucky because at least I had enough capital to get to profitability. And so we've been profitable since 2019, and it's also a mindset. So that's when I meant, don't panic. So I think it's important. And I also chose like an industry, chose a business model which can ensure that we don't fail or we don't fold easily.
I love that. So I was not aware of that, that it, you guys are profitable already. That makes a massive difference. Congrats in the first place.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's like a general congrats, because it takes a lot to reach to that point.
Appreciate. Yeah, so I think we might not have chosen like the sexiest business model and everything, but ultimately we're making an impact, we're scaling sustainable, but it's easy to get distracted, lose that as well.
So the business model as such has been sustainable. It's been thought through the angle of being sustainable since the beginning.
Yes, absolutely.
And
if we don't, then it's very easy to make rash decisions and then not make the impact. So for example, like if you want to make a positive financial impact on the borrowers, but then you also need to make revenue, or like many times those will be in contradiction to each other. So we've tried to be on a very strong footing so that at least a core mission can be achieved of improving finances, like for people. At least we should not spoil it for anyone.
Yeah. I'm totally loving this conversation. I could go on and on, like we were just having like coffee.
absolutely.
But just
about fintech all day.
Exactly. Just to start wrapping things up, you've been in the business for a long time now. What, if you were to look back, what's one of your biggest lessons that you're like, oh man, that was hard. That was a big one.
I would say two or three. One is that we've been regulated, but still, I've seen a lot of companies being on the wrong side of the regulator. And it is, at least in India, like I definitely feel just being very conscious of not just the letter, but even the spirit of the regulator and being on their right side is like super important. That is my lesson, that don't take a chance there. That's not worth the risk. I think in terms of fundraising, in terms of capital providers, it's like you said, most founders might not have the luxury of being picky, but I would say as much as possible, be picky, because it is a marriage and you need to have the right person by your side. If even if, let's say, they're not able to help you with the next round of funding, but at least they should not stop you or hinder your business or meddle too much. So I think really being selective and finding the right investor is also critical. Who would understand what you want to achieve and who would also be able to support you through that time period. Yeah, thirdly, I started off as a solo founder, but yeah, adding like co-founder, adding the leadership team. So it feels obvious, but when you're doing it, it's actually not that easy to implement. That's super critical. So investing in your people basically before your growth happens, I would say that's a...
We're reaching to the end of the episode.
Yes.
So this is one of my favorite questions that I ask every single guest. If you were to change one thing, it's only one thing in fintech to make the industry better for customers, colleagues, and shareholders, what would you change?
Yeah, I think the customer centricity is still not like where it can be. There's too much jargon, there's too much lingo, there's still too much influence of thinking like a banker across industry, despite it being fintech and trying to disrupt it. So I think in terms of customer centricity or having that right balance, like people are only customer centric or people are only compliance centric, having that right balance is very difficult. And I think we need more of that across all the people in the industry.
So I'll summarize that as double down on customer centricity while keeping the balance with compliance and commercial.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So three C's, you could say.
The three C's.
Yeah.
New framework.
Customer, compliance, commercial, balancing all three together. So,
yeah, definitely. I love it when we come up with frameworks.
Yeah.
Remember. Cool. Aditya, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in the show. Thank you so
much. Likewise. Thank you, Moni. See you up the day.
Yes. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. Your time and energy means a lot. If you want to support the show, remember to give it a follow and DM me to get in touch. I promise I do respond.